New wheels, new dreams, new wheels, new dreams. Despite everything happening in the background of my life, new beginnings still found their way to my doorstep. Sometimes the excitement of something new offered a welcome distraction from the struggles at home. Diane had always loved her Renault Mégane, but when the new model came out, a sleek, hardtop convertible with smooth new lines, the temptation to upgrade was too strong to resist. London showrooms had long waiting lists, but I wasn't one for sitting around when a solution could be found. A few phone calls, a bit of persuasion, and I tracked down a dealership out in Reading willing to offer a part exchange deal. It was a bit of a drive, but that didn't bother us. We made a day of it. Driving out through the gray London suburbs into open countryside, it felt like the weight of everyday life was slipping away, just for a while. Diane smiled properly for the first time in ages, the kind of smile that lit up her whole face. Watching her drive away from the Reading showroom in her new car, the wind lifting her hair, was a moment I tucked away for myself. Back in London, opportunities were stirring too. Adrian Wickham had stepped in as Glendale's new manager at Lewisham Council, taking over from Craig Davis. Lewisham had taken notice of the buzz and growing footfall we had created at Manor House Gardens. They wanted to spread that success across 12 of their parks, and they thought I was the man to do it. I didn't exactly know what my formula was yet, other than sheer stubbornness and the knack for making a cafe feel like home. But I said yes. The list of parks was long and varied. Sydenham Wells, Mayo Park, Chinbrook Meadows just behind us at Chinbrook Road, Telegraph Hill, Ladywell Fields, Hilly Fields, Forster Park, Deptford Park, Horniman's Triangle, Blythe Hill Fields, Eckington Gardens, and the windswept expanse of Blackheath Common. Some parks had old changing rooms or basic buildings we could convert into serve-over cafes. Others had nothing at all. Blackheath, for all its grandeur, offered little more than an old tea hut tucked away near Greenwich Park. I pictured something different, a catering tram, styled like a Victorian streetcar, serving sweet and savory crepes, coffee, tea, ice creams, and soft drinks. Something that would blend into the Heath's heritage without looking like a cheap kiosk. The council agreed and even offered us a prime pitch, by the pond, opposite the Princess of Wales pub. They even let us tap into the power supply from a nearby lamppost, which felt like a small but important win. However, landscaping work started around the pond just as we were getting ready, so we had to set up further over by All Saints Church, where the heath rolls wide and flat toward Lewisham. The scale of the project was daunting, and I knew I couldn't do it alone. I reached out to two people I trusted, a tan, a gifted chef, and an old friend, and Clive, who I knew through Marco's church. Clive had been going through tough times, recently made redundant, mid-divorce, raising his kids on his own. Our own bond wasn't forged through prayer meetings, though. It came from the weekly squash games we played in Brixton, often ending with a pint at the local pub. When Marco mentioned over a drink that I'd landed the concession for 12 parks, Clive lit up at the idea of getting involved. I liked Clive. He was warm and keen, and it felt good to offer him a fresh start. We moved quickly. A company was set up, and the deposit was paid to Towability in Wellingborough to custom build the tram. Meanwhile, we got to work outfitting the parks, converting an old changing room at Chinbrook Meadows into a hatch with no indoor seating, doing the same at Sydenham Wells, and refitting a small building at Ladywell Fields near the public toilets into a modest cafe with a few tables inside. Joe Beswick, who lived nearby and could get there by bus, took charge at Ladywell Fields. Ben, now working and a driver, was given responsibility for Sydenham Wells. Those first weeks were a blur, exciting but absolutely exhausting. Then almost immediately came the problems. Within days of opening at Ladywell Fields, vandals had broken in, trashing the place 3 times in just 10 days. We had to reinforce the ceiling and replace the old barn doors with solid steel just to keep the cafe standing. At the same time, the partnership started to splinter. Atan, as brilliant as he was, had been offered a contract with Qantas Airlines to produce in-flight meals. It was too good an offer for him to refuse, but it left us short-handed. Clive, for all his enthusiasm at the start, seemed to enjoy the title of director more than the hard work that came with it. Most afternoons you could find him at his local wine bar, loving the attention that came with his new role and charming the women who now seemed to gravitate towards him. In the end, it left me carrying the load, racing between parks, dealing with unreliable staff, and fending off the council asking why certain cafes weren't open. When the tram finally arrived, it was beautiful. Polished wood, gleaming brass, a real nod to another era. We installed it by All Saints Church, looking out over the heath. Diane's French tenants, who were renting from her at the time, were pressed into service running it. Being French, I figured they'd know their way around a crepe pan, and if they didn't, I would teach them. The idea was to make the tram a permanent fixture, but we hadn't accounted for the storm brewing beneath the surface. The Blackheath Traders Association found out about the tram, and they were furious. Apparently, nobody from the council had thought to consult them. Philip Furnett from Glendale warned me there was unrest, but assured me it was all noise. The heath was managed separately from the shopping streets, and technically the traders had no say. Still, as a precaution, he gave me the keys to a Glendale depot nearby and suggested I tow the tram away at night. Towing that tram was a nightmare. Reversing with a trailer is an art form, one I had yet to master. You steer the opposite way to where you want to go, correct before jackknifing, and pull forward again to straighten up. Most nights it took me an eternity under the cold stars to park it properly. But the traders didn't let up. The pressure grew. Eventually, the deputy mayor got involved. Glendale backed down, and we were told we had to move. It was a bitter blow, but I wasn't finished yet. We relocated the tram to Telegraph Hill, a beautiful park with a new children's playground and no food outlets. It seemed a natural fit. The French girls quickly made a name for themselves, and the smell of sweet, lemony crepes drifted across the park, drawing in the crowds. Someone even said our crepes were better than the famous ones at Hampstead Heath. But after dark, the atmosphere changed. Groups of teenagers would gather, not always with good intentions. One evening, the park ranger confessed he had been trapped inside his office by youths, only rescued hours later by the police. It wasn't safe to leave the tram overnight, so every evening I returned to help the girls pack up and towed it back down to Chimbrook Road. One night, so exhausted I could hardly think straight, I reversed too sharply and crunched the tram straight into the side of Diane's brand new Megane. The look she gave me said it all. Still, we pressed on. For almost a year, we juggled staff and tried to keep the trade going. Business was brisk on cold and rainy days, but exhaustion was setting in. There were too many incidents of staff not turning up, too much pressure from the council asking why certain cafes were closed. My little cafe at Manor House Gardens was starting to show signs of neglect. I knew it was time to come clean. I handed the concession back to Glendale and the council. The only thing left was the tram. To their credit, Glendale threw me a temporary lifeline. Gemma, the new events manager, brilliant and full of energy, invited us to trade at the major events held in the parks, the London Marathon, Bonfire Night on the Heath, and others. The days were long and punishing, but they offered some hope. Bonfire Night stands out most clearly. Thousands of families gathered on Blackheath, the night sky alive with fireworks. The tram glowed warmly by All Saints Church, a beacon in the darkness. Diane helped me that night, serving cups of tea, hot chocolate, and crepes to hold happy crowds. But when the last fireworks faded and the crowds began to thin, trouble erupted. Fights broke out between gangs of youths, violent, sudden. Bottles smashed, fists flew, and the police struggled to regain control. In the middle of it all, the tram became something else entirely. Diane, calm under pressure, threw open the doors and started pulling injured teenagers inside. We used tea towels to stop bleeding, bottled water to rinse out wounds. For a few hours, our little tram became a sanctuary, a makeshift ambulance in the chaos. Despite those memories, Bonfire Night alone couldn't keep the business afloat. The tram needed monthly payments, and event days were too few and far between. Just when it seemed like the end, Steve, a tall, upbeat man I'd known through mutual friends, approached me. He had arranged a permanent pitch for the tram at Bugsby's Way Retail Park, near the Greenwich Odeon. It sounded promising. I told Steve he'd need to buy into the business and run it himself. He agreed. Bathgate Leasing were paid off, and Steve took the reins. In the end, though, the new site never truly took off. We eventually sold the tram back to Towability for £12,000. A bittersweet ending, but a clean one. Months later, Sally's GP, Desmond Thompson, returned from a fishing trip in Ireland, laughing as he told me he'd seen a familiar sight, our old Pistachios tram, sitting proudly by a quiet lakeside. "I couldn't get away from you," he grinned. And neither, it seemed, could I. With the 12-part cafe concession behind me, we hired a unit at Big Yellow Storage on the roundabout off the South Circular. Inside it, we kept all the espresso machines, prep counters, and leftover equipment from the parks. One by one, we started listing items on eBay, selling them off to recoup what we could. By 2005, I was back at our cafe, pushing sales and planning events again. The monthly farmers market, held on the last Sunday of each month, was building momentum, drawing in more footfall with each one. That summer, Bob Geldof announced another global concert, much like the legendary Live Aid of 1985. This one was called Live 8, a string of benefit concerts held on the 2nd July 2005 across the G8 countries and South Africa. Timed just ahead of the G8 summit at Gleneagles in Scotland, Live 8 was designed to shine a spotlight on global poverty and put pressure on world leaders to take real action. 10 simultaneous concerts were held on the 2nd of July, and one more followed on the 6th of July. On 7th of July, G8 leaders pledged to double aid to poorer nations from $25 billion to $50 billion by 2010, with half of that earmarked for Africa. Over 1,000 musicians took part, with the concerts broadcast across 182 TV networks and 2,000 radio stations. The reach was staggering. An estimated 30 million people tuned in globally. I thought, wouldn't it be incredible if we could be part of this? I had a vision. A huge screen erected on the green opposite the cafe, with the lake and fountain as the backdrop. Our own open-air Live Aid experience in Lewisham. I contacted the organizers, Harvey Goldsmith themselves. After a few persuasive conversations and emails, they agreed to let us screen the entire event. We even secured TV rights. The BBC were planning to send a cameraman to capture the local crowd, cutting live between cities. Lewisham Council initially backed the idea. The momentum was exciting. Diane applied for marketing material and helped distribute a big box of Make Poverty History white rubber wristbands that had been sent by the organizers, a unifying symbol of the campaign. Everyone wanted one. But as interest swelled and crowds were anticipated, the council lost their nerve. Fearing a turnout they couldn't manage, they pulled the plug just days before the event. We were left deflated and, frankly, a bit humiliated. So much planning and promotion had gone in. I couldn't understand how the council could pass up this level of global visibility. The BBC's plan was simple. During the concert, Bob Geldof would call out to each city, "Hello, Cardiff," cue roaring crowd, "Hello, Glasgow," another cheer, and then, "Hello, Lewisham." We were meant to feature among them. 30 million people might have heard our name, a small park in a so-called impoverished borough, given a moment of international attention. You couldn't buy that amount of publicity. But that wasn't to be. Still, we decided we wouldn't cancel. We pressed on with a stripped-back version of the event. Gemma from the council stepped in with method statements and risk assessments to keep it official. We invited Jimmy Botten's Family Fun Fair to set up bouncy castles and kids' rides. Lenny, the old gent who gave donkey rides near Greenwich Park, came with his donkeys and bales of hay. I bought a huge TV and stand and set it up by the cafe so we could still show the concerts. The day was a blast. The music, the energy, the wristbands, everything came together. Live 8 was brilliant, and the atmosphere was electric. By evening, the fun fair packed up and Lenny took his donkeys home. We shut the cafe but didn't want the night to end. The concert was still playing, so we decided to stay in the park. I asked a few strangers nearby if they fancied ordering a takeaway with us, and to my surprise, about 40 people agreed. Everyone chipped in, and we dragged tables together inside the cafe, eating and watching the show as a community. Strangers became friends that night. It was a shared moment that people talked about for weeks after.